Tomorrow is the deadline for county clerks in Wisconsin to deliver ballots to local election officials for the November general election. Some third-party candidates have fought to get their names on or off the ballot in time.
Last month, the Wisconsin Supreme Court decided not to hear a challenge from Democrats seeking to get Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein off the ballot.
And yesterday, a Dane County judge denied Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s request to be taken off the ballot after he dropped out of the race and endorsed Donald Trump.
Eric Lepp is an associate professor in the Department of Politics, Government, and Law at UW-Whitewater. We talked with him Friday about how third-party candidates have impacted past elections in Wisconsin and their influence in the lead-up to November. Eric, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Good day to you all. Thanks for having me.
So Robert F. Kennedy Jr. was running for president as an independent until he suspended his campaign in late August, endorsed Republican nominee Donald Trump. Can you help us with the basics here of Kennedy's campaign in Wisconsin? What are the arguments for and against Kennedy remaining on the ballot?
So the tricky issue here is that Wisconsin has a deadline in early August of filing paperwork to run as an independent, and Robert Kennedy did that. The laws in Wisconsin also say that once you have done that and you're successfully qualified, you can't really back out of it unless you happen to die. So when Robert Kennedy later in August, after that deadline passed, decided to endorse Donald Trump, he now has this puzzle of being on the ballot and kind of being stuck there. And right now he's currently working on kind of the last legal opportunity to potentially get off that ballot before ballots began getting printed.
There was sentiment from Kennedy's supporters that his First Amendment rights might be violated by not being able to get his name off ballots here. What do you see in terms of the argument?
So it's kind of tricky, right? Because the First Amendment says we can associate with who we want. And so logically, you could see the argument that people may want to stop associating with a group if they want to. The tricky part, though, again, is that through that nomination process, Robert Kennedy chose to be affiliated with an independent party bid. And no one stopped it or no one prevented him from doing that before. It was all on, you know, his decision, as was the decision to endorse Donald Trump later. So given that the law says that once you have qualified to be on the ballot, you can't be taken off of it just because you change your mind, that's going to make it a little bit tricky to argue the First Amendment case simply because the original decision to run was Robert Kennedy's through and through.
Meanwhile, Jill Stein running for president as head of the Green Party, as she has in previous elections. Stein will stay on the ballot as Kennedy is trying to get removed from the Wisconsin ballot. How do you see the interplay here, these two candidates affecting election results?
So in a state like Wisconsin, of course, every vote matters. And when I talk to my students about this, I always say that in the last few statewide elections, or at least most of them, the difference between the winner and the loser was about one end zone of Lambeau Field, right? Mm-hmm. So it's always very close. Anytime there are candidates running for office who are not one of the two major parties, they have the potential to pull some voters in who would otherwise vote for those major parties. So in the case of Stein, as well as Kennedy, as well as others who are on the ballot, their presence, even though they're not going to win, and even though they're not going to garner large vote tallies, their presence is still going to pull potentially thousands of voters away from either Vice President Harris or former President Trump. So although they can't win, they do have the potential to have an impact on which of the major party candidates do.
And the potential impact, Marquette University Law School poll just took the pulse on this in their most recent poll of Wisconsin voters, finding third-party candidates got 9% of the vote. RFK got 6% even after he had announced he was pulling out of the race. What can that tell us about what we might see in November?
Well, it certainly tells us that the potential for a minor party candidate to We often use the word spoil an election, and I don't mean that in a negative way as much as I mean to impact the outcome, right? Whether you consider it spoiled or not is up mm-hmm. to the individual, I suppose. But if polls are showing even single digits, remember, the difference in Wisconsin is often 1% or 2% and sometimes even less. So I imagine that if additional polls are taken as we get closer to November, that third-party vote share will probably go down a bit as more people learn about Kennedy dropping out and endorsing Trump. Trump, or more people start paying attention and feeling kind of the grind of the two major party candidates. But even in really, really close elections in Wisconsin, we see those third parties win enough votes to potentially tip the scales.
You mentioned the vote spoiler label, and I'm wondering if that label is problematic to seeing third parties in a different light.
Yeah, you know, I kind of pull back a little bit at the term spoil, just because everyone should vote the way they wish, and I don't want to suggest that a spoiler is necessarily a bad person or someone trying to undermine democracy. What we mean, though, when we say spoil is basically the idea that their presence can tip the election outcome to one major party or the other, even though it can't really tip it towards the third parties themselves. So depending on your political views and which major party you're a part of, you would be thrilled to see certain third party or minor party candidates on the ballot, because you would hope that they might pull a few votes away from the other major party and that those voters would kind of split a little bit. Again, not 50-50, but they would split some of the voters on the left or some of the voters on the right in a way that would help the other major political party.
Can you go back in history for us in previous elections? Why do we see somewhat successful third-party candidates during some elections but not others? You know, 2016, it seemed like third-party candidates got a bit of a boost in the election results. 2020, not so much.
A lot of it has to do with what the state of the feelings about the major party candidates tend to be. Mm-hmm. You might remember in 2016, there were a lot of people in Wisconsin and across the country who were not especially thrilled with either major party candidate. When those kinds of elections come along, you tend to see a boost in the third party vote share. But of course, it's important to remember that the third parties still never really come close to winning. The most famous example, of course, is 1992, when Ross Perot won almost 20% of the vote nationally, but he didn't get any Electoral College votes.
We're talking with Eric Lepp, associate professor in the Department of Politics, Government, and Law at UW-Whitewater, looking at the impact of third-party candidates, and specifically in Wisconsin elections. Eric, we mostly see discussions around third-party candidates coming up during presidential election season, but are third parties very politically active down ballot on the local and state-level races?
It certainly can be the case. It's also important to remember that if you're a third party, what you consider to be a victory or to be a success in terms of your political mission may not necessarily be to win election or even to get on a ballot. When you're a third party, the major parties will often try to win you over, to win your endorsement, say, kind of like Robert Kennedy, actually. And so they may be willing to maybe adjust their views on the minimum wage or something related to the environment. So third parties are often working behind the scenes with major parties trying to push their policy agendas. The major parties are often willing to work with them because they don't want to have any competition. So you're right. The third parties, although we talk about them during election season and the potential spoiling effect that they may play on election day, they often are working throughout the year and between elections to try to negotiate their place and affect the policy agendas of the major parties around them.
And on the point about competition, there are concerns coming from Democrats that are accusing Republicans of boosting third-party candidates like Jill Stein that way to encroach a bit, to eat away at Democratic support in states where we're seeing the battleground, where the margins could be really close, like here in Wisconsin. Could this strategy be in play?
It could be, but of course it's important to remember that any minor party that chooses to run for office has to go through the process of getting on the ballot, you know, getting the signatures and paying the fees and such. So it's certainly the case that a major party could try to nudge or support a minor party that would potentially hurt their opponent. But that happens kind of across the spectrum.
Do you think third-party candidates cause voter confusion?
You know, it's certainly possible. I mean, imagine a menu at a restaurant or picking an olive oil, you know, picking olive oil at a grocery store. The more options you have, the more there is to process, right? It's just a lot of cognitive task on the part of the voter. And you often have third parties with names that may not be terribly clear in terms of where they fall ideologically. For example, the Independent Party, right? Where does that mean politically moderate? Does it mean They don't like the two major parties. Similarly, you might have a party like the Constitution Party, which might sound kind of conservative, but then people might say, well, what's the difference between the Constitution Party and the Republican Party? So it's certainly possible for voters to struggle with trying to process a lot of different party options sometimes.
All right. So we do hear the frustrations about this two-party system, that there should be more viable choices for voters. We've talked about ranked choice voting in the past. Where do you stand on these arguments and these tensions around the system in America?
You know, it's always interesting to look at the data on how many people are satisfied or not with our current two-party system. And the data recently are showing pretty consistently that there's a lot of people out there who would love to have more options. Ranked choice voting is certainly one way we could go. There are other rules too, like a proportional representation system, where you don't simply give out seats one by one to whoever wins a district, but you divvy up the seats based on the percentage of votes. So maybe a Libertarian Party comes along in Wisconsin and wins 10% of the vote statewide, they could get 10% of the seats in the legislature. So those kinds of systems are certainly out there. I'm, of course, a big fan of voters having choice, but I'm also a fan of voters being able to make sense of the political system. So you're right, there's a real delicate balance between kind of having enough choices and having too many to be able to process it all. As a practical matter, it's unlikely we'll see major changes like moving to proportional representation or moving to a national popular vote, because it's really, really hard to change current election rules. You know, people in power, people who would have to agree to make those changes are the people that got there under the current rules. So they're not necessarily keen on shaking things up. But as we have multiple elections in a row with a lot of people saying, I'd like to see more choices, it's certainly possible that there might be some major donors or former partisans who get together and say, maybe we could push out a message and try to create a new political group that advances our political conversation. Again, though, let's bear in mind that it's unlikely that we'll see a move away from two major parties and a handful of minor parties anytime soon.
Okay, so with your academic hat on and the researcher in you, what are you watching for in third party as we head into the November election?
Well, of course, one thing to look at is how many people who are currently undecided or currently supporting third-party candidates decide to move to one of the major party candidates as we get closer to the election. When somebody calls you on the phone and asks who you're going to vote for, it's easy to say that you're undecided or to say, you know what, I don't like any of the major party candidates. I think I'm going to vote for Jill Stein. It's possible that some of those folks actually move over to support one of the major party candidates, because when you get in that voting booth, the reality is only one of the two candidates is going to win Wisconsin. It will either be Donald Trump or Kamala Harris. And if you vote for a third party, even if they most align with your political views, or even if you are really, really supportive of what they're trying to do, or they're your next door neighbor, the truth is voting for them means you're not actually participating in the competition that really matters, which is Harris versus Trump. So a lot of people will probably decide to vote for one of the major parties so they don't, quote unquote, waste their vote. That's another term like spoiling, which is perhaps a mixed one to use these days. So I'll be watching to see how many people start to move towards one of the major party candidates versus really stick with the third party and say, no, I want to make a point here. I'm not happy with either of my major party options.
Eric, thank you for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Be well.
That is political scientist Eric Lepp at UW-Whitewater.